Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Azadeh Mashiri from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the dramatic series of pager explosions across Lebanon. As security experts scramble to piece together the paper trail, armed group Hezbollah firmly believe Israel are responsible and say they intend to retaliate. So what's next? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. And you join us as there may be very significant developments happening over the border between Israel and Lebanon. We'll get to that in a moment, but I just want to put this in some sort of context because almost a year ago, the Hamas massacre in Israel and Israel's massive military offensive in Gaza, well, that all began as a huge shock. In contrast, what is currently happening over Israel's northern border, its border with Lebanon, does feel like a much more signalled, choreographed walk towards possible all-out war, a war between Israel and the very powerful Iran-backed Lebanese militia Hezbollah, a war which, were it to be unleashed in full, could well be far more devastating even than the war in Gaza. What has happened in Beirut, in the southern Beirut suburbs within the last hour or so, has been an airstrike on what the Israelis are saying was a major Hezbollah target, according to the Ministry of Public Health in Lebanon. Three people have been killed. There have been pretty much daily exchanges of fire between Hezbollah and Israel since last October. This week, you may recall, Hezbollah communication devices were blown up in 2 days of attacks, which left thousands injured, more than 30 dead. Hezbollah, though, has been trying to show that it still poses a threat to Israel. This was video shot in the southern Lebanese town of Marjayoun, capturing the sound of rockets thought to have been fired from Lebanon into Israel. Well, as I mentioned, within the last hour or so, there has been that airstrike on the Dahiya suburb of Beirut, killing three and injuring 17, according to the Lebanese Ministry of Public Health. Dr. Matthew Levitt is director of the counterterrorism program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and is a specialist on Hezbollah. Dr. Levitt, welcome to NewsHour. What is your assessment of what is going on in this exchange of fire, this apparently escalatory exchange of fire between Israel and Hezbollah?
Pleasure to be on the program again. Israel appears to have conducted a targeted killing of a senior Hezbollah operative. Rumor is that it is Ibrahim Akil, one of the last remaining members of the Jihad Council and the most important one after Fuad Shukr, who was killed in an Israeli strike several weeks ago. This comes, of course, in the heels of the attack against Hezbollah's communications gear, first pagers, and then a day later, handheld radios. Doing this a day apart obviously increases the anxiety within the organization. It eliminated from the battlefield a significant number of Hezbollah operatives, and it also disrupted their communications. Those two things combined make it more difficult for Hezbollah to respond to an attack like the one Israel appears to have carried out today. And if on top of those two setbacks, Hezbollah now is losing their top commanders, it puts the organization on a back foot in its nearly year-long daily back-and-forth attacks.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, there has not been confirmation yet, and often these things do take a little bit of time, that Ibrahim Akil has been killed. But if he has been killed by the Israelis, I mean, it would be a significant blow after the killing of Fuad Shukr, the number two in Hezbollah at that time, back in July.
Absolutely. And the other person that I'd be looking at if I were a targeter is Ali Karaki, who's the third in that kind of top triumvirate of the Jihad Council. The Israelis apparently took a shot at him and barely missed back in February. And there's clearly an effort to do what can be done short of a ground invasion and full-scale war to diminish Hezbollah's capacity to conduct full-scale war. Really what they want in the near term more strategically is to get Hezbollah to stop firing rockets on a near daily basis into Israel's north. There are some 60,000 Israeli civilians who've been displaced from their homes. It's a political, economic, even for the children educational school system, crisis across the political spectrum. There's wide support for doing something to get those people to be able to go back home. Ironically, people from the south have gone home, people from the north have not. I think that explains why we're seeing this series of incidents.
Yeah, I guess the other question, though, and it is, you know, one that must be asked both in Lebanon and in Israel, Lebanon, where there has been massive displacement in the south, as well as Israel facing tens of thousands having to leave their homes in the north, is whether this move to get both sides to desist can best be arranged militarily through there being a bigger confrontation or diplomatically.
To be sure, a diplomatic solution would be far more preferable. I think we are where we are because the diplomatic efforts that have been ongoing now, not for weeks, but for months, led by U.S. diplomat Amos Hochstein, have led nowhere. Hezbollah insists that it will continue firing rockets into Israel in support of Hamas until there's a ceasefire. Hamas, and for that matter, Prime Minister Netanyahu neither seem eager for that ceasefire for different reasons. And so the diplomatic effort focused on the north has not gone anywhere successful, which leads us to where we are. The Israelis have said quite publicly for quite some time, if the diplomatic process doesn't work, we'll do things other ways. I'm sure if you asked them, they would tell you, we gave this weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks to work out diplomatically, and now we are where we are.
Yeah, but I mean, just to put it fairly bluntly, it would be a disaster for the Biden administration if they were faced with all-out war between Israel and Lebanon just weeks before the election.
To be sure, it would be far more devastating for Lebanese civilians and Israeli civilians both. It would be a political hot potato here in the United States. But I think what Israel is doing is saying, look, enough is enough, and we're doing everything we can short of full-scale war. Okay. Whether that will be successful, I can't tell you. What comes next? I'm too smart to try and answer that question. But yes, there's a very tense moment that we are going through right now.
Matthew Levitt, thank you very much for joining us from Washington. Well, let's head south now to Israel, where Hezbollah has been trying to show that it still poses a major threat with a salvo of rocket attacks into northern Israel shortly before we came on air. Anshul Pfeffer is one of Israel's most seasoned journalists. He writes for, among other things, The Economist. He's written a biography of the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. What's his sense of this apparent progress towards all-out war?
What we're seeing here are a series of stages of escalation, ratcheting up the dial. Not quite yet all-out war in which Israel and Hezbollah unleash their entire arsenal of formidable firepower. But over the last few days, we saw with the pages and walkie-talkies then, we saw last night with probably the widest series of Israeli airstrikes on Hezbollah launching pads in South Lebanon and the Bekaa Valley. And now, literally minutes ago, this targeted strike in the Dahiya neighborhood of Beirut. So, you know, it's not a rush to the war in the sense that there was a lot of expectation after the pager bombings that this would be the immediate prelude to an all-out war. What I'm hearing from Israeli officials is that they're giving, in between these stages, time for some kind of engagement via various mediators with Hezbollah to see if Hezbollah is prepared to a ceasefire, to stop firing on northern Israel. But it's continuing apace.
I mean, do you get a sense that one of the criticisms about the way in which Israel has prosecuted the war in Gaza, I mean, there are lots of criticisms, but one is that it is not clear what the end game was in Gaza, because this sort of airy objective of defeating Hamas and ensuring that it would never, ever pose a threat against Israel was by many seen as being difficult, if not impossible, to achieve. Do you get a sense that there is a clarity of objective about Hezbollah?
I'm not quite sure about the objective, but certainly the strategy or the tactical stages here are more thought out than the Gaza war has been. The Gaza war began with this huge shock for Israel. Israel didn't expect Hamas to carry out that kind of attack. And I think everything that continued since then hasn't been has largely not been very well thought out. Israel has been preparing for a war with Hezbollah for many years. The idea that Hezbollah was building this massive arsenal of missiles that it has, there was no other target for these missiles, which was supplied by Iran, other than hitting Israel at some point. So Israel's resources, intelligence resources, planning, strategy have been focused on a possible war with Hezbollah for a long time. And then we've had the past 11 months since, as Orla said, on the 8th of October, Hezbollah began firing rockets on northern Israel. Israel, at first, I think throughout most of this time, didn't want to have to fight on two fronts an all-out war, but it looks as if we're now at the stage where the emphasis has moved from Gaza towards Israel's northern border and towards Lebanon, and they've had a while to plan this, and what we're seeing now is a series of planned moves.
And do you think that there would be widespread support in Israel? I mean, I've obviously heard, as I'm sure you have, from plenty of people in northern Israel who say we have to move fast and move far against Hezbollah. But do you think there would be widespread support for an all-out war and all that that might entail?
I think at this point, the Israeli public is prepared either for a war or for a ceasefire, but anything which will allow around 60,000 Israelis to return to their homes near the border in the north and to restore some kind of calm in northern Israel. And like I said, it could come through some kind of diplomatic arrangement. Right now, it looks more likely that it's coming through war.
And in terms of the possible ground incursion that would result from that war, does Israel have the resources? Because, I mean, many of its soldiers must be exhausted from 11 months of fighting in Gaza.
Well, that's very hard to say. I mean, we do know that a second division has been deployed in recent days up north. So there are already ground forces in the area. From what I know, they're not yet ready for a full-scale ground incursion. And as you said, that would take a lot of resources at a time when the Israeli army still is fighting in Gaza, perhaps not at the same level as it was a few months ago, but there is still a major involvement there. And the war has been going on for almost a year now, so there's fatigue, there's need for rest and refitting the army. And indeed, within the army, there are different approaches, whether this should be something that should be carried out mainly through air power, or will there be inevitably a need to go in on the ground as well.
And that was Anshul Pfeffer, the Israel correspondent for The Economist. We have a live page on our BBC News website, bbc.com/news, with all the latest on what is happening in Israel and in Lebanon. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming up on the programme, we'll hear from Springfield, Ohio in the United States about how unsubstantiated rumours of Haitian immigrants eating people's pets has affected the local community.
I'm up here getting my grandkids at the same school I got my kids from. Everybody's cats are safe. Dogs are safe. You go up here at these factories, this big factory, go in the bathrooms, there's kill the Haitians on the walls. I mean, it's bad.
That report from Springfield in about 20 minutes. A headline from the BBC newsroom this hour. Israel and Hezbollah are continuing to exchange fire across the Lebanese border. The Israeli military says it's carried out what it calls a targeted airstrike aimed at a senior commander of the militant group in Beirut. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service, with me, Tim Franks. China has fortified its border with Myanmar by building higher walls and holding military drills as the civil war on its doorstep threatens its investments and its economy. Beijing has also dispatched its top diplomat, Wang Yi, to try to persuade Myanmar's military rulers to return to peace talks and hold nationwide elections as promised. Myanmar has been thrown into fresh chaos in recent months after a China-brokered ceasefire in the north of the country fell apart. Armed ethnic groups have made huge gains, capturing key cities and towns on the main road to China's border, which some believe could be a turning point in the civil war. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker has this report from the China-Myanmar border.
Ni hao. It's like a jade necklace. A Burma jade.
Burmese jade traders in China beckon us to their stalls.
Very beautiful.
They're desperate for a sale. 70% of the world's jade comes from Myanmar, and yet they tell us the price has plummeted. Strict COVID lockdowns have ravaged this border economy, and now the war has blocked key trade routes into China. Beijing desperately needs stability if it's to rebuild local businesses. Your country's at war, just accept what I give you, shouts one Chinese man haggling for a bargain.
Oh, yeah, the market's lovely. Got colourful flags all around it.
The local maze-like market has stalls brimming with other goods, from milk, tea to tobacco. The few people that make it over the border to China are searching for peace. They have hopes of prosperity. But stallholder Li Mianjian says it's hard to make a living when so many here are just glad to be alive.
It's really, really cruel. I don't know when things can start to improve. I hope some decent people can tell all sides to stop fighting so the ordinary people can suffer less. Otherwise, it's really tragic for us. You know, the bombshells hit hospitals. People were killed, including women giving birth there.
For Myanmar families with the right paperwork, the Chinese city of Reili has become a safe haven.
From here in the middle of the square in the baking sun, I can see over the border into Myanmar. Scattered around the square are mostly women with lots of their belongings. Some have their papers on the ground as they try to get a work permit in order.
Another border checkpoint. China fortified this once porous border during the pandemic, building higher fences, more checkpoints. Loudspeakers still warn Chinese tourists to stay back from the high steel fence. Just a few miles away, armed insurgents have stepped up their fight against the military regime. A Beijing-brokered ceasefire was ripped apart, and thousands have fled the fighting. In response, China is holding regular military exercises along the border. State media said this is to maintain order. Beijing also dispatched its top diplomat, Wang Yi, to Myanmar to push military rulers to hold promised elections. After long shifts making car parts and clothes, dozens of Burmese workers relax playing volleyball. They've been brought from Myanmar as cheap labour for Chinese factories. Zinong is 31 and fears he would have been forced to fight if he'd stayed.
There is nothing we can do because war is happening in Myanmar. Everything is expensive. Everywhere there is a battle going on, and everyone has to run because of war.
His work here comes with conditions. The movement of Burmese workers is often restricted. And enterprising locals have set up food and karaoke stalls to keep them entertained. The future prospects of this town and these workers are in Chinese hands. As Beijing calculates just how big a part it's willing to play in Myanmar's fate.
Laura Bicker reporting from the China-Myanmar border. This time yesterday, we were bringing you the news revealed by the BBC that several women had accused Mohammed Al-Fayed, the former owner of the London luxury store Harrods, of raping them. Today, lawyers representing some of the 37 women who've now accused Al-Fayed of rape and sexual assault say that the billionaire who died last year was a monster whose behaviour was enabled by the department store. Gloria Allred is a US attorney and one of the representatives on the international legal team. Does she think there may be even more who suffered at the hands of Al-Fayed?
Absolutely more. In fact, additional victims are contacting the barristers. They began contacting them as soon as the BBC documentary began to be broadcast and also began to be streamed yesterday. And then they are still getting contacted by even more victims today. So who want to retain this legal team, the barristers, to represent them. The barristers have been working for more than a year investigating this matter and representing some of the victims. So, yes, they think that they have strong legal arguments to make, strong factual arguments to make, and definitely there will be more victims that will be represented by these barristers.
And obviously every single victim has a terrible story to tell, but along with that comes the question, just the sort of the mind-boggling question, and it's the same one that we asked about Epstein and Weinstein and the other type of powerful men who've been predators, is how could they get away with it for so long and with so many victims?
And that is an important question. And part of it is because the victims were threatened by Mohammed Al-Fayed if they came forward or told anybody. They had to keep it a secret. He told them that usually every time after he victimized them. And also said that we know where your family lives, and suggested that to one of them they would never work in London again if they told anybody about what he had done to them, and more. And actually did inflict gender violence on some of the victims, that even after they said no, they did not want him to rape them, to attempt to rape them, to assault them. Then sometimes he would force himself on them anyway. So this is very serious. He knew exactly what he was doing. He used Harrods and many of the employees at Harrods to recruit the victims. Some of them were just people shopping in a store, 15-year-old girls, 14-year-old girls at the time, shopping in Harrods. And he looked at her and decided he wanted her and went up to her and offered employment to her.
Given that Al-Fayed died last year, what does justice look like?
Justice, well, it's never too late to do the right thing. And offering to resolve this case in a way that would be meaningful to the victims is something Harrods can do. Harrods has suggested that the new owners have suggested that Harrods did fail these victims. And that's a good start. But we need to have meaningful financial compensation for the victims so they can pay their therapy bills, their physician bills, and more bills, lost wages.
Gloria Allred, the U.S. attorney and representative of the international legal team of women victimized by Mohammed Al-Fayed. This is NewsHour.
I'm Azadeh Mashiri from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the dramatic series of pager explosions across Lebanon. As security experts scramble to piece together the paper trail, armed group Hezbollah firmly believe Israel are responsible and say they intend to retaliate. So what's next? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, if you're going to do the commentary on a moment of sporting history, here's how.
1-2, Otani sends one in the air, the other way, back it goes, gone! One-of-a-kind player, one-of-a-kind season, Shohei Otani starts the 50-50 club!
An impressive bit of comms for an impressive bit of baseball history. The moment the Japanese player Shohei Ohtani became the first US Major League player to achieve 50 home runs and 50 stolen bases in a single season. He did so as the Los Angeles Dodgers smashed the Marlins in Miami. Jim Allen is a baseball writer based in Tokyo. How big has this deal been in Japan?
It has been top news in Japan for most of the day. Hitting the airwaves, I guess it was around 8 a.m. here when it happened. We're getting now all the reactions from all the former players, you know, the former greats, the legends who are coming out and saying about what a marvelous thing this is and what an individual marvel Shohei Ohtani is.
Baseball is absolutely huge in Japan, isn't it?
It is. It is. They've been playing it for over a century here, and they've been playing it professionally for nearly that long.
So, I mean, does that mean that there is immense pride in Shohei Ohtani? Or actually, is there a measure of regret, I wonder, about the fact that he's playing in the US, that the Japanese league is just not big enough to have a star of his nature?
Well, I think that's the reality. That's the reality of today's world and exchange of players between leagues, is that until Japanese baseball decides it wants to be the best, it's going to lose its best many of its best players to the American majors.
And in terms of the guy himself, I mean, clearly just the most stellar sportsman, he is quite a modest sort, isn't he?
He is. He's very humble, very much into, I think, in the moment. He's a remarkable person, I think, and I wrote about this today, that what perhaps makes him most remarkable is not necessarily his physical talent, but his ability to set aside things that are extraneous to the moment. So he's been through, for example, this year started with a huge scandal surrounding his interpreter who embezzled millions of dollars from him. And there was a shadow of a doubt was cast whether he had been illegally gambling. And he just put that on the back burner and just went out and had the best season he's ever had as a hitter.
Jim Allen, baseball writer, speaking to me from the Japanese capital, Tokyo, about the phenomenon who is Shohei Ohtani, the Japanese player who became the first U.S. Major League player in baseball to get 50 home runs and 50 stolen bases in a single season. And the season's not over. You're with the BBC World Service and live from London, this is NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. It is difficult to get a handle on just how much of an awful mess Haiti is in. With the collapse of government, not the government, just government, and the widespread grip of gangs, the violence and disorder have led to thousands being killed this year. Hundreds of thousands have been displaced. There is some hope that a new interim prime minister, his name is Gary Conille, along with a Kenyan-led force of international peacekeepers, might help. But just how far there is to go has been underlined today by William O'Neill. He's the UN independent expert on the human rights situation in Haiti. And at the end of a 12-day mission in the country, he's been speaking to my BBC World Service colleague, James Copnell.
The situation is catastrophic. It's worse than when I was here last year in October, November. The security situation is very bad. The situation for the humanitarian issues like access to food, healthcare, water. The capital is basically cut off north, south, east, and then the west is the water. So it's hoped that now that the 400 Kenyans are here, there's some Jamaicans coming, some from Belize, the Haitian National Police, they're doing amazing work, but it would be really good once they're able to maybe start to go after one gang after the other and start to liberate territory and free up roads. I think that was the plan, but it's taken such a long time to get the Kenyans here. They don't have the right equipment. They don't have helicopters. They don't have the right type of vehicles. There's a real mess with their logistics. It's not their fault. So that's frustrating, really frustrating for the Haitians, but it's taking so long. And I think that's one of the main problems.
When you say that things got worse since your last visit, how do you explain that?
I think a lot of it has to do with the crisis for about 4 months, from late February into early June, when the gangs really did almost take over the whole city. and the former prime minister was never able to get back into the country. Time is against reform. Time works in the gangs' favor. The gangs have used that time to replenish their arms and munitions, most of which come from the United States. I think it's a shocking failure on the part of the United States to stop these weapons from getting here. And so they've been able to get stronger. And in the meantime, the international force has taken such a long time to get here. As I mentioned, the new government, which really only started working in early, mid, late June, is still finding its way. They have a totally different approach, I have to say. I met with the previous prime minister. I've met with the current prime minister, Gary Cooney. It's a totally different ballgame. Prime Minister Cooney is very committed to bringing change, to trying to get things right here. But it's complicated. It's hard. He doesn't have enough of anything. Nobody has enough of anything. That's the problem on the good guys' side, if I could use that term, whereas the bad guys have lots of things.
We were reporting yesterday about the fact that a committee has been set up as part of the process of arranging an election in a couple of years' time. But listening to you, that sounds like almost an irrelevance. I mean, if the security situation is not sorted out, there's no prospect of elections, is there?
Absolutely correct. Yes. And unless you get the security situation under control, nothing else is possible here. The humanitarian situation is dire. The WFP statistics for famine are only going to be going up. 5-6 million people are food insecure, on the verge of famine. Most of the hospitals in Port-au-Prince aren't working. The hospitals outside in the region, I was talking to medical officials yesterday in Jérémy, one of the larger cities in the Southern Peninsula. They said unless a patient comes with everything they need, including medications, surgical gloves, syringes, whatever, they won't be able to help them. So, you can sense, I think, the frustration and anger in my voice, but it's outrageous as this has gotten to this point. The Secretary General the other day made a very strong statement, I thought, saying, you know, Haiti shouldn't be this difficult. It's not that big. It's not Sudan. It's not Ukraine. And it's not that much money that's required both to fund the international force and to fund the humanitarian appeal, which is at a shockingly low, about 20% has been pledged. And we're not talking about lots and lots of money on an international scale. It's peanuts.
And that was William O'Neill, the UN independent expert on the human rights situation in Haiti, speaking to James Copnell. Let's stay with Haiti, or rather Haitians, because you may recall that early last week during the US presidential debate, Donald Trump gave voice to the unsubstantiated rumour that immigrants from Haiti had been eating cats and dogs in the town of Springfield, Ohio. Since then, the town has been shaken by far-right marches, bomb threats sent into local schools, and an amplification of existing tensions between communities. Our US digital reporter Mike Wendling has visited the city where fake news about pet eating has clashed with very real issues faced by the town and its recent arrivals.
Rumors are swirling here in Springfield, Ohio. There's talk of white vans moving immigrants into the town, when really they're moving them to and from their factory jobs. Far-right groups have been marching in the streets, and there are fears they'll return. Earlier this week, local schools were closed by hoax bomb threats. It's letting out time at one of the primary schools here in Springfield, and there's a discreet but definitely noticeable police presence. The authorities have ordered state troopers to be posted outside of all the schools in the district here because of the dozens of bomb threats, most of which the governor of Ohio says have come from overseas. Parents here are concerned, a little bit wary, but most of all baffled as to what's happened to this community over the past week.
There's always a concern. I think they need to leave the schools out of it.
I'm up here getting my grandkids at the same school I got my kids from. Everybody's cats are safe. Dogs are safe. You go up here at these factories, this big factory, go in the bathrooms, there's kill the Haitians on the walls. I mean, it's bad.
Despite the rumors, the one thing that most parents here agree on is that the granddaddy rumor of them all, which started all of this off, is absolute bunk.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people.
It's been just over a week since Donald Trump stood at the podium on a national TV debate stage and said something out loud that had its origins in the dark corners of the internet. It began with a Facebook post recounting a cat-eating allegation written by a Springfield resident who attributed it to the friend of the daughter of a neighbor. She's since taken the claim back, but not before it became entangled in the fractious U.S. political race and turn this normally quiet city of 60,000 upside down.
Haitians who have just been minding their business, going to work and coming home, are now terrified to walk on the streets.
Laura Kovaleski grew up in Springfield. She and her Haitian mother run a translation and advice service for immigrants here.
There's a woman who came with her small son, who's probably around 4 years old, and she just wanted a one-way ticket to Brazil because she's terrified of someone killing her son. Her walking home, she gets people yelling at her, screaming at her, and she knows it's hateful, but she doesn't understand what they're saying.
Local business owners have praised Haitians for their hard work. They've revitalized many of the factories here. But they've also put strain on schools and hospitals, and the swelling population appears to have increased rents. The city council says there's anecdotal data that the new arrivals are having high rates of traffic collisions and launched a number of driving instruction initiatives to address this. Tensions in the community are evident. But in the face of all the negative attention, there are signs that Springfielders are sticking together. At a Haitian restaurant in South Springfield, businessman Jacob Payne takes a quick break from ferrying dishes of rice, beans, and stew from the kitchen.
For the past week and a half, 96% of our guests are non-Haitian. Before, we did have a few here and there. You know, they wanted to try the culture, try the food out of curiosity. Now, they've been coming by numbers to support us.
For now, things here in Springfield may have quieted down. The governor of Ohio says bomb threats have tapered off, but Springfield's moment in the spotlight might not be over quite yet. Donald Trump has suggested he'll hold a rally here in the near future.
And that was Mike Wendling reporting from Springfield, Ohio. It's the problem lots and lots of parents face. How do you persuade your small child to eat what is in front of it? How can you persuade them not to be a fatty eater? Well, new research suggests that the cause of that fussiness may well be genetic. In other words, nature rather than nurture. In other words, less reason for the parents to feel guilty about their hopeless parenting. Claire Llewellyn is Professor of Psychology and Epidemiology at University College London and senior author of the study.
We undertook a twin study of fussy eating, and we measured fussy eating behaviour at five different ages, all the way from toddlerhood at 16 months of age to early adolescence at 12 to 13 years of age, in a large cohort of families with twin children in England and Wales, so about 2,500 families. And we compared the fussy eating behaviour between identical twins who are genetic clones of each other and the fussy eating behaviour between non-identical twins who are about 50% genetically the same. And what we observed was that fussy eating behaviour was much more similar between identical twin pairs than it is between non-identical twin pairs. And that indicates that there must be quite a strong genetic component to a predisposition to express these fussy eating behaviours.
I have to ask, what prompted you to look at this? Because, I mean, it clearly is it's a very interesting sort of area of study and yeah. Something that, I mean, means a huge amount to lots of parents, I'm sure. But tell me what led you to it in the first place.
The Gemini study, it was started in 2007, specifically to understand genetic and environmental influences on early growth. And early growth is really important. And as part of this study of understanding growth, we measured a variety of different types of eating behaviours, which we know relate to different weights of children in the population. And fussy eating is one of these. And over time, we've actually extended the study. So the children are now nearly, well, they're 16, 17 years old, which is not only important for growth and development, but there's an increasing interest in whether, for example, early origins of problematic eating behaviours later, such as eating disorder symptoms, whether they start in early childhood. I would have to say, too, as a confession, I was a terribly fussy eater myself. I ended up being referred to secondary care when I was 11. So I have lived experience of it. I have a very fussy eater now who's 4 as well, probably inherited my genes.
If parents themselves say they were once upon a time fussy eaters, but they now no longer are, and then they decide to have children, is there a way in which, because of the change in their behaviour, there's mm-hmm. there's less of a chance that their kids will be fussy eaters?
Genes are not destiny. So just because a behaviour has an important genetic component to it in terms of someone's predisposition towards being fussy, it absolutely doesn't mean that you can't do anything to reduce the expression of that behavior or change it. So at all the different time points, there was some evidence of environmental influence. In toddlerhood, at 16 months of age in particular, that was largest. So that was indicating to us that that really early period of life where we know from other studies that food preferences, for example, start to be formed and eating behaviors really start to kind of become expressed. That seems to be a window of opportunity for parents to really help their child to try a wider variety of foods and so on.
Claire Llewellyn, Professor of Psychology and Epidemiology in University College London, with that fascinating insight into the genes or genetic predisposition of fussy eaters. You're listening to NewsHour. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC. New research has revealed that the number of identified Russian fighters killed on the front line in Ukraine has reached 70,000. The figure was calculated by the BBC Russian service and the independent Russian news website Mediazona. Olga Ivshina is with the BBC's Russian service. What's the significance of this figure?
I guess our audience have heard the different figures from British intelligence, American intelligence. The importance of our figures is that these are all verified names. These are people we know many things about. And built together, those thousands of stories, thousands of obituaries help us to paint the picture. They help us to see certain tendencies. So it's not just the numbers. It's also the story behind those numbers. And what we do see now is that the biggest category of all people killed in action in Ukraine on the Russian side are now volunteers. So it's not regular soldiers, not prisoners as before, but people who decided to join Russian forces after the start of the full-scale invasion into Ukraine. And they're mostly in their 50s, 40s, and sometimes even 60s.
I mean, that is extraordinary. I did see on your research that's available online that there was a 62-year-old, I think, that you highlighted. I mean, that is very old. Is there a sense from the accounts that you're picking up as to how well trained they are, what sort of medical help they get?
Yes. So first, the biggest trouble is they're not. It seems they're not getting enough training before they get to the war, and that's the reason they die. Many of them do die pretty quickly, sometimes within 1 month of being sent to the front line, sometimes even within a week or so, because the training is so short. So we see that as Russia is inflicting tremendous damage on Ukraine, Russian officials are at the same time inflicting damage on the Russian society as well, because those people are being withdrawn from the civil economy, from the civil society. Also, as a part of previous effort, many prisoners were drafted into the military, and according to the previous deal, many of them were released after 6 months on the front line. So now they're back to the society, committing new crimes and skipping the trials because they volunteered to go to the front line again. So it's like a vicious circle.
And I guess it also emphasizes that presumably the total number of Russian casualties will be much higher, because this is what just the numbers that you've been able to verify.
Yes, the real numbers are, of course, way higher, because this 70,000 is just what we are able to confirm via open source. These are names of people we know. Of course, not of them are being mentioned publicly, so that part of data is missing. But because of the sheer scale of the numbers we managed to confirm, we can talk about certain tendencies.
How far is this sort of information open to Russians inside Russia?
It's a good question. I guess it depends on how much you really want to know. So we see that people in Moscow and St. Petersburg are quite interested. They're consuming that sort of information, that sort of piercing the information bubble, pro-Kremlin propaganda is trying to create. But people outside of those big cities, especially those living in smaller towns, villages, less educated people who work at not well-paid jobs, they care about it less, so they don't search for it. That's why it seems many of them are signing those contracts.
And that was Olga Ivshina from the BBC's Russian service. You can find out more about her, what she discovered online, bbc.com/news. Let's turn to the other side of the battle lines. In Ukraine, millions are struggling with mental health issues caused by the war. Now, some of them are trying to join forces to find ways to tackle a problem which can still carry stigma. Vitaly Shevchenko reports.
Maria Ivashchenko is one of the hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians who have lost loved ones in the war. Her husband Pavlo volunteered the day after Russia invaded in 2022. 6 months later, he was killed as Ukrainian forces went on a counteroffensive in Kherson region. To cope with her grief, Maria has been attending therapy classes where widows and mothers of fallen soldiers express their feelings, seek solace and closure by painting.
When you're painting, you externalize and process everything, all the memories and moments that you were afraid to relive and process. There's total trust. No one will judge you whether you laugh or cry. They understand you unconditionally. There's no need to explain anything. This project has pulled many of us out of the abyss.
The project is called Alive, True Love Stories, and it was founded by Olena Sokalska.
Their painting is to depict something that reminds them of the time they spent together or of the dreams they had. They paint themselves, their husbands. Very often they paint angels. Their families or children are depicted as angels. There are a lot of landscapes showing places where they met or were happy together. These paintings mark the end of the life they had and the beginning of a new life.
In addition to the trauma of bereavement, the dangers and insecurities of war have deeply affected millions of Ukrainians. Ukrainian psychotherapist Anna Stativka explains.
What happens when the war starts? You lose the basic human resource, safety and stability. So it creates a lot of stress, some symptoms of chronic stress, anxiety, depression, apathy, insomnia. You cannot be for a long time in this hyper alert state without consequences for your mental health and for your physical health.
The share of Ukrainians experiencing mental health issues has exploded since the start of the war. According to the health ministry, the number of patients reporting mental health problems this year has doubled since 2023, with antidepressant sales having jumped by almost 50% since 2021. One study even suggests that more than half of Ukrainians suffer from PTSD. And according to Anna Stativka, Ukrainian society has responded to the trauma of war by coming together.
People are much more ready to help to each other. People even are much more polite, even in supermarkets or public places. People begin to, for example, communicate more with neighbors. You see that so many people are volunteering, so many people are donating, so many people are trying to help to each other, help to older people. We observe much more trust and much more empathy, I would say.
Maria Ivashchenko is now raising 4 children on her own. But she's smiling again, even if there are tears sometimes. Her message to those who are struggling is clear.
Don't be afraid to talk to people. Get out of your bubble. Don't be alone. The most important thing is not to give up and not to think that you're alone in this world or that nobody cares. Oh, yes, they do. Life goes on. Our husbands did not go there so that we sit around crying, but so that we keep moving on, so that we keep living.
Maria Ivashchenko, ending that report by the BBC's Vitaly Shevchenko. That's it from NewsHour, from all of us here. Thanks for listening.
I'm Azadeh Mashiri from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the dramatic series of pager explosions across Lebanon. As security experts scramble to piece together the paper trail, armed group Hezbollah firmly believe Israel are responsible and say they intend to retaliate. So what's next? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.